The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. Tractor Supply trusts 5G solutions from T-Mobile. Together, we're connecting over 2,200 stores with 5G business internet, empowering AI so team members can match shoppers with the products they need faster. This is enriching customer experience. This is Tractor Supply with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
She said, get out the chat room and clean my Glad Stretch. Feeling fine, so fresh.
The Glad Girl Group coming at you with a throwback jam. That was Glad Force Flex Drawstring Trash Bags featuring Pine Sol Original Scent. And that's better than all good. It's all Glad.
Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have an exciting founder, the founder that has done it multiple times, you know, and we're going to be talking about the building, the scaling, the financing, the exiting, so all of the good stuff. You know, we're going to be talking about how to think about acquisitions, how to do diligence perhaps on the potential acquirers, how to raise money, how to think about raising money and the lessons, you know, along the line, you know, of raising capital. And then also why climate, you know, with his current business, which is a rocket ship. But again, very inspiring conversation that we have in front of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Duncan Logan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So originally born and raised in St. Andrews, you know, which people may recognize, you know, for golfing, you know, in Scotland. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Yeah, well, I'm probably living proof that there's nothing genetic about golf. I love to play it, but I'm not very good. But yeah, I was very fortunate to be born and bred in the kind of home of golf in St. Andrews, Scotland. My parents were farmers. They had a pretty large, about 5,000-6,000 acre agribusiness up in Scotland. My father was very pioneering in trying to grow new crops like broccoli or or lettuce or so forth in Scotland. So that was my my upbringing. I then went to university up in Aberdeen, which is an oil town, as most people know, for North Sea oil, and studied agriculture up there. But at the end of the course, decided to go into derivative trading in London. So I first worked for Lehman Brothers and then for Swiss Bank. I did their graduate program and became a derivative trader in London. After a couple of years of that, I really longed to do my own thing. So I broke out and became an entrepreneur, and I've been an entrepreneur ever since.
So then let's talk about becoming an entrepreneur. You know, what was that thought process? You know, because obviously you were coming from, you know, humble beginnings, you know, your parents were farmers, you know, here you were, you know, graduating from school, being in banking, you know, corporate job, you know, that was quite successful, you know, so why, you know, throwing everything, you know, to the side and venturing into the unknown? I'm sure that was not an easy process for you to really take the stance and go.
Yeah, I think a lot of people thought I was crazy at the time. I think that the actual trigger point was bonus time in the bank and realizing that, you know, a large part of my my income and my career was in the hands of other people. And one year I felt I got sort of passed over a little bit on bonuses, which are a big part of why you're doing banking. And I just said, you know, I need to be more control of my destination. And I found an opportunity to set up a customer relationship management business actually focused on banking. And we set that company up and I got it going. And 3 years later, we sold it. So it turned out to be a really good decision.
So that was CityPearl. You guys ended up selling it for $8 million. So I guess the question that I have for you there is, I know that on the diligence side, you know, there was like quite, you know, a few lessons that you got. You know, I obviously, you know, like they were doing a ton of diligence on you guys, but perhaps you did not reciprocate. So what was the lesson there to be learned?
we built the company. It grew very quickly. And then we got this offer for acquisition from actually what was a publicly traded company on the small, called the AIM market. And they came in and did their full due diligence on us. And we were sort of wowed by the money and the terms, and really did no due diligence on the team that were acquiring us. And, you know, they acquired us in the year 2000. Things got tough for the company, but the deal terms at the last minute were swapped from sort of high cash, low equity to high equity, low cash. We still took the deal, which we shouldn't have in hindsight, but yeah, the equity turned out to be worth zero. And it was only when I got into the company after the acquisition that I realized, you know, they had sold us on something which really was pretty fanciful to what the truth was. So that was a lesson there. And if you're going to get acquired, do your due diligence on the acquirer as much as they do it on you, and the people running the deal. I mean, at the end of the day, so much of business comes down to the quality of people, you know, and you got to do your diligence on how those people have behaved in the past, and you know, that gives you a pretty good indication of how they'll behave in the future.
So then in this case too, I mean, what was that full visibility into the full cycle of a company, you know, from building to scaling to reaching the finish line?
Yeah, well, it happened very quickly. I started the company when I was 24, and we sold it when I was 27. So I think, and it was, you know, I always talk about these stages of competence, you know, from unconscious incompetence to conscious incompetence. You know, that's a huge step. I don't think we really ever got out of unconscious incompetence. We were just lucky on timing. You know, as long as there was paper in the fax machine, the orders kept coming in, and we just deployed assets against it and made sure that, you know, our people costs were less than the revenue coming in, and the business was on a tear. So, we never really, you know, it was a quick MBA into how to run a business, but, I was definitely more lucky than good in getting that business to an exit.
So talking about getting an MBA in business, you know, you joined your friend, you know, and you got going with Message Labs as the next chapter. That was a pretty smashing outcome of a transaction. So walk us through, how was that journey like? I mean, why joining a friend versus doing it again on your own?
One of my customers at Citipro is a company called Star Internet, and it had this really awesome founder, CEO, a guy called Ben White. And Ben and I had become pretty close, and he just described to me this idea he had for scanning email rather than scanning it at, you know, at the desktop, of actually scanning it at the ISP. And it just made so much sense to me. I just within 15 minutes of him telling me the idea, I was like, this is going to, you know, this is going to change the security market. This is going to be a huge company. And so, the timing was fortuitous. So I jumped on board, joined the company, and I really only meant to stay for 6 months or maybe a year. But I learned so much in that business. And, you know, we built the company from, you know, just a few of us up to 700 people. And we ended up selling the company to Symantec. And I think I stayed for, you know, over 6 years because I just learned so much about sales, so much about product and market fit and scaling, and I just loved every day of working for that company, and you know, thought it was a good, you know, I was learning stuff every day, and you know, we're fortunate in 2008 that Symantec came along, wanted to buy the company, and that transaction went through, even though 2008 was a pretty hairy time to get a deal done.
I mean, 700 million was the transaction. I mean, what a smashing outcome. What do you think were the main ingredients that allowed for that incredible outcome to happen?
It was a well-structured deal in that the company, you know, I had learned all the SaaS metrics about, you know, ARR and recurring revenue and so forth. And this was, you know, Ben was a real pioneer in the SaaS space. And companies were learning that this idea of people paying, you know, per person per month was just a very sticky good business model. So when you take that revenue and then you look at where you are in the market adoption, and I'll never forget that, you know, when Symantec came in, they said, you know, we think you're just getting to an interesting part of the market where you're moving from the, you know, the early adopters into the majority. And that's going to see incredible growth over the next 4 or 5 years. And, you know, here we were thinking, oh my God, we must be far further along in market adoption than just, you know, 7-8%. But they were absolutely right. And it was a great deal for them. They took the company and grew the revenue significantly over the next 3, 4, 5 years. And I think everyone was super happy with that deal. It, you know, I think it was a great deal for Symantec, a great deal for Message Labs and all involved there. And it was a great learning opportunity.
So here, what was different, you know, when it came to the acquisition, to the M&A experience, that perhaps, you know, it just felt different from what you guys did on the first transaction?
Yeah, Message Labs was a much bigger company. It had a much more professional executive team. It had, you know, CityPro didn't have any investors. Message Labs had lots of investors. So there was far more experience heads looking at the deal. And it was a risky time to get that deal done, but, it was just quality people who had experience dealing with other quality people. And I think everyone was happy with the deal that got done. And that also triggered a really, you know, big thing for me, which was to get out to Silicon Valley.
So talk to us about getting to Silicon Valley. You know, how was that for you too? Because, I mean, obviously quite different from the Europe, you know, and Scottish, you know, type of look and feel.
I think whatever you do in life, getting to hang around the best people who do that is really critically important. So I don't care if you want to be a ballerina or a sports person or a musician or whatever, but being able to practice your craft while surrounded in an ecosystem of the absolute pioneers and best of that ecosystem is phenomenal. And it kind of comes into the model that we're building at 9-0. But I just was like a moth to the flame of wanting to get to Silicon Valley. And, had the opportunity to do it. I got a visa and got out here. And it's been the best move I ever made, without a doubt.
So then let's talk to us about the next chapter then, because the transaction happens with Message Labs and then you're like, okay, let's go again. Rocket Space. So Rocket Space. Yeah. Why Rocket Space out of all things at this point? You know, you had two transactions under your belt. You really had visibility into business models, into building and scaling companies. So Rocket Space, why?
So Rocket Space was an ecosystem play. And I started Rocket Space in 2011. And you could just feel, it's kind of interesting because it kind of feels the same as where we are today. But in San Francisco in 2011, there was just this feeling of we're through the worst of the financial crisis, and things are going to start building and growing again. And the idea of Rocket Space was really taken from Y Combinator. Y Combinator is this phenomenal accelerator program where people go in and turn their ideas into a business. And the program lasts for, you know, 12 weeks. And then at the end of that, they all disperse and go their own way. And I just had this idea of, why don't we build a space that Y Combinator companies could stay in that ecosystem in a kind of graduation school. And we called it Rocket Space. We weren't affiliated with Y Combinator in any way, but I put the idea together and put it out on the internet, and the response to it was just incredible. Companies started phoning. I hadn't found a building, hadn't found space, but people started calling me and saying, hey, I hear you're building this thing. Can we get some desks? Can we move in? And it was sort of co-working before co-working existed, but with a very focused approach that you had to be a technology company to get in, and you had to have raised one round of funding before we would consider you. And it just took off like a rocket. And we were fortunate to have, you know, people like Spotify and Uber and Kabam and Mog and Supercell and all these unicorn, what turned out to be unicorn companies coming into Rocket Space. And I think the ecosystem just harnessed this idea of building big, fast-moving companies. And when you're surrounded by, you know, when so many companies around you are unicorns or building unicorns, I think you get, the struggle to build a unicorn becomes less. You know, it's a bit like running the 4-minute mile. You know, if everyone else around you is doing it, then it just feels ultimately more possible to do. And yeah, it was just an incredible ecosystem, an incredible environment. And, you know, people like Flexport, Ryan, and all these amazing companies just came through Rocket Space at this same.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. Together with Delta, we're putting 5G into the hands of ground staff so they can better assist on-the-go travelers with real-time information. From the Delta Sky Club to the Jet Bridge, this is elevating customer experience. This is Delta with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
With the $5 meal deal at McDonald's, you pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a 4-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Price and participation may vary for a limited time only.
Sort of time.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com, and we would love to take a look at helping you out. That's amazing. So with Rocket Space, you guys raised quite a bit of money. You know, how much did you raise, and what was that experience of raising the money?
So we raised a total of 3 rounds of funding. There was sort of friends and family, early investors, and then we raised this big round of funding, $336 million from a Chinese entity called Hainan Airline Group, H&A. And I had spent, because we had Uber and Uber were pushing into China, I had been going to China and had a kind of interest. And everything I heard was, you know, America was growing rapidly, but China was just growing at this different pace. And the people of China had been given a sort of taste of capitalism, and they were just loving it. And so the more time I spent in China, the more I just thought there was a really big opportunity there to help connect China and America through technology and ecosystems. So we ended up taking this deal, $336 million from Hainan Airline. They were great people. They did a lot of investing into the US. They bought Ingram Micro for, I think, $7 billion. They bought 10% of Deutsche Bank, 25% of Hilton. They bought Gate Group, Menzies, a lot of airline service companies, Avalon Aircraft Leasing. So they were a very experienced deal team, very Western thinking. They had a big team in New York. And everything seemed to be going, you know, really great until the Chinese government, I think, had a change of heart and said, listen, all this money leaving China needs to come back. And they were relentless and brutal about it. And very quickly, it became clear that things at H&A were changed. I think some of the executives put in house arrest. You know, it just became really impossible to get things signed off. They were obviously a board member. And I don't think we would have learned anything different doing different due diligence on them. They were a very aggressive, very gregarious company. And I generally enjoyed working with them. But once things changed politically in China, and then obviously Donald Trump became president and kind of the China-American relationship soured. And it just became, you know, we tried to bring in an investor to buy them out, but they wouldn't sell their position. And it just became, you know, we started losing key members of staff. And it just became a real hardship to the point where we had a meeting one day and we just decided to, you know, we would wind the company down and return the capital. So that was an unfortunate end to Rocket Space, yeah.
That's amazing. So what a wild journey. Now, I guess for Rocket Space, obviously, you know, the incredible lesson learned there, no? I mean, I think that, you know, it's either you succeed or you fail, no? And in terms of the journey, and the journey that you had with Rocket Space is absolutely amazing, you know, from start to finish. I guess the outcome obviously is not what everyone had hoped for, but without a doubt, you know, I'm sure that the journey was unreal, you know, for you too, no? So I guess what was the take, you know, as a whole, you know, when it comes to the lesson that you're taking, you know, especially from a journey that doesn't have the desired outcome, you know, what was the takeaway for you?
I think as an entrepreneur, you have to decide what drives your passion. And you could definitely, there's lots of entrepreneurs who avoid venture capital, avoid taking in external investors, you know, build incredibly successful businesses with no external shackles, if you like. And it tends to be a slower ride. You know, I've always just been driven to want to build big, fast companies because that's just what kind of motivates me. And the China thing, I think there's a million ways for a startup to die. And we always see this. It's that, you know, some company would be doing phenomenally well, and then, you know, there's some macro change which is way beyond their, you know, beyond their control, and it just kills the company. And, you know, for a company actually to make it to an exit, what you know is they have managed to get around, get over, work through just so many different challenges that, you know, it's a marathon and it's grueling, but they make it to the end. Make it to the end zone. And very few companies, you know, percentage wise, very few companies actually make it. So I think that the learning was, I actually really enjoyed the journey of building Rocket Space, and it didn't give, you know, the outcome. And it felt terrible that, you know, on paper, I think everyone, staff and investors thought this is going to be a great outcome. And then we just, you know, found ourselves in this predicament that, it wasn't. And, you know, that was a shame, but I still enjoyed the journey. I still think I learned a lot, and I think it sets me up well for what I'm building now. And hopefully we can navigate, you know, the choppy waters that I'm sure will be in front of us to get to a better outcome this time.
Well, there's always choppy waters, you know, without a doubt.
For sure.
Always choppy waters when you're in startup land. But now for you, you know, it sounds like climate change, you know, was, you know, what came knocking next. So, you know, in this case, you know, you thought it made sense to jump in. So walk us through the thought process, you know, to really, you know, bring the company to life here.
Yeah. So I think there's two core things. If I'm, you know, and I want to be really honest about this. The first one is absolutely, I have two little children, you know, 9 and 6, and that's their ages, not their names. You know, they are little climate warriors going through the California school system, which is great. And I live in Santa Barbara in a fire zone. You know, Santa Barbara's being plagued with landslides and forest fires and stuff. And you just see climate change, the effects of it all around us. But the starting point was that indefinitely my kids. And then I started to look at climate as a marketplace. And then the most incredible thing happened. I realized what the size of the climate problem is. And from an entrepreneur, you look at, when you find a big problem, the thing that excites you is it's going to need a big solution. And I think most people fail to understand that the climate revolution is going to dwarf the digital revolution. If we think the digital revolution, which we've all lived through, you know, with the production of mega companies like Microsoft or Amazon or Google or Apple, you know, the climate revolution is going to dwarf. Digital revolution produced 4 mega companies. Climate needs to produce 80 to 100 companies of that size. It is incredible the size of what we have to solve for in climate. And I genuinely think, it's not a common view, but I genuinely think if we can make it a capitalistic solution, we will get a lot more people, a lot more investors excited about solving climate change, which we're going to be forced to do. Either, you know, over the next decade, 20 years, we're going to spend trillions of dollars on climate change, either trying to defend against the effects of climate change or putting in solutions to reverse climate change. The truth is, we're probably going to do a lot of both, but it's been forced upon us. We're not going to have a choice. This is going to be a multi-trillion dollar marketplace. And part of my job is to encourage more entrepreneurs, more investors to get involved. So that was the starting point. And I think capitalism, as much as it kind of feels bad to be saying we should make money out of climate change, I think it's the best tool, the best way we're going to solve climate change. It can't be, we're never going to solve climate change through scarcity. We can never say to people, stop flying, stop driving, stop eating meat. What we have to do is innovate to come up with cleaner methods of mobility or cleaner food, cleaner processes. And that is going to happen. And I have no doubt the human race is not going to disappear off the face of this earth. We will solve this problem. But the longer we leave it, the more it's going to cost. So that was the draw, just the size of this problem and therefore this opportunity was really a big draw for me to come into the climate market.
So then for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of 9-0? How do you guys make money?
Yeah. So 9-0 is an ecosystem play. We are trying to build the ecosystem to make it, you know, this is from my background of rocket space, but what we're trying to do philosophically, we're solving for serendipity and critical mass. Where others are solving for linear progressions, 9-0 is more likely to drive an exponentiation of the entire market versus a 1 in 100 exponential outcome for a single innovation. And what that really gets to is we're trying to work out how can we make the marketplace for entrepreneurs who are trying to build solutions for climate, how do we make that marketplace far faster, far easier to drive success? And a starting point for this is, you know, for an industry of this size, which is just getting started, there is no Silicon Valley for climate. There's no Hollywood for climate or Wall Street for climate. So that's our starting point. We're going to start by going to 8 cities in the US and build a climate district in each of these cities. So we're starting in San Francisco on California Street. And, you know, in a decade, we want to see California Street as the climate alley for San Francisco. Then we'll look at Seattle and LA, and then Boston, New York, and other cities across the US. And in each one of those cities, we want to build this community. And this kind of comes back to my background. You know, my first career in banking, the city of London was that banking ecosystem where everything sort of happened. And sure, in the evening, we might head to the West End of London, which was more the media publishing area. But these ecosystems were really powerful. And if you wanted to get into banking or you're passionate about banking, just being in the City of London or Wall Street here in the US would have been a great start. It's where you can build your connections, your network, and away you go. And you're likely to work for several different companies in that space. And so I think post-COVID, there's a real opportunity to build those ecosystems again. And that's what we're purposely trying to do. So we have started with some event space, some co-working space, some club space for drop-in memberships. And we're pulling together private equity companies, venture capital companies, the sustainability teams of corporations, obviously a lot of startups. And we're pulling these companies into an ecosystem where they can quickly make both digital and physical networks to pull this together. And you know, we'll do a geo-focused ecosystem for the Bay Area. So bring everyone working on climate in San Francisco and the Bay Area together into 9-0 there. And then we'll do other cities. And then once we have that network across the US, we can start moving from the geo focus into like the niche focus. So now we can start pulling together all the people working on energy or energy storage or sustainable aviation fuel or whatever. So we move from the geo focus to a niche focus as we bring that community together. So that's the business.
And then also, how have you guys gone about capitalizing the operation?
We have various investors. We're raising capital at the moment. You know, we're still very early. 9-0, we put 9-0 together. We registered the company in October last year. We got our first building in a partnership with SKS and Swig in San Francisco at 350 California Street, which is a 300,000 square foot building, mostly empty, like a lot of buildings in San Francisco, which we're now attracting as many climate companies into that building as possible. We're raising a friends and family round of capital into the business at the moment. And then we will go on to raise a seed and an A round and so forth from, you know, probably more from family office, high net worth, maybe corporate. Moving forward. So it's another funded business. And we think there's a big outcome to be generated by this. You know, we are building a sort of LinkedIn for climate throughout our membership. And that is something we're really excited about and is already showing, you know, great traction. So we're really excited for that.
So I'm going to put you into a time machine right now, Duncan. Imagine if I was to bring you back in time. And I bring you back to the late 90s, you know, maybe to 97, where you were starting to think about a world where you would bring something of your own, a company of your own. And let's say you were able to stop that younger self on your way out from, you know, the corporate world. Let's say you just gave your notice and you're now venturing into the world of being an entrepreneur. And let's say you're able to stop that younger self and give that younger Duncan one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
I think there's so many things I would go on there. I think the first thing is I think it would be really worthwhile as a young person to kind of think more about what your entire career should entail. What's the common thread through your entire career? And then compound on that experience. So, you know, I've managed to do that in small parts, but not holistically as much as I probably should have. And what I mean there is, if you want to be an entrepreneur, you know, if I said, well, the security business was one I obviously did with Message Labs. And so I'm going to build one company in the security business and then another company in the security business and then another company in the security business and so forth. And you end up building six or seven companies in that vertical. I think you can compound on your knowledge, your network, your people, the team and everything. And it just gets stronger and stronger. I think when you flip from one industry to another, you bring a certain amount of knowledge, but you also discard a lot of value in you know, pushing that forward. So I think that would be something, you know, back saying, hey, this is the swim lane I'm going to stick to, and I want to build my network, I want to build my reputation, I want to build the trust and team and everything in that vertical and stick there. I think that's probably an easier way to get to significant outcome or multiple significant outcomes, you know.
So for the people that are listening, Duncan, that would like to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Email duncan@9zero.com. You can check out our website at 9zero.com. But just duncan@9zero.com. But love to hear from people if you're passionate about climate, passionate about entrepreneurship, capital, any of these areas. It'd be great.
Amazing. Well, Duncan, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. Tractor Supply trusts 5G solutions from T-Mobile. Together, we're connecting over 2,200 stores with 5G business internet, empowering AI so team members can match shoppers with the products they need faster. This is enriching customer experience. This is Tractor Supply with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.